At the end of last class, I wrote down this matrix, which corresponded to the pseudoscalar octet. The matrix was this matrix M. And I'm free to parameterize the elements of M in any way I like. But I'm going to try to argue that it's useful to take the following parameterization, since this is what will correspond to the physical states. So I have pi 0 plus eta, pi plus, pi minus, minus pi 0 plus eta. And then I have k plus, k 0, k minus, k bar 0, and then minus eta. Like this. Okay. So, okay, maybe it's just magic to write this down, but what I showed you at the end of the last class is you could compute the T3 and the T8 quantum numbers for each of these physical states, and so you can characterize each of them by those eigenvalues. Now the question is, how do we get the symmetries of the strong interaction that we started with out of the SU3? Those symmetries were SU2 isospin and also strangeness. So that's the question. How do we get SU2 isospin and strangeness? How are these symmetries embedded in the SU3? So it's probably, maybe it's obvious for the isospin part. SU2 isospin is just an SU2 subgroup of SU3, and it's just the subgroup that just lives in the upper 2x2 block of the SU3. So SU2 isospin is a subgroup of SU3 flavor acting on only the UD part. So if I wrote the general SU3 matrix, so this is the 3x3 SU3 flavor transformation, I could write that as some 2x2 parts and then just 1. So V, the thing that lives up here, would be the isospin transformation. Okay. So now we can act, how do isospin transformations, how does that subgroup act on this matrix M? So it's easy to see what happens. Let's just act with it on M. So we have M goes to U, M, U dagger. And so that's just V and then 1 acting on M and then acting on V dagger, 0, 0, 1. And now I'm just going to expand what M is. So that's just equal to, of course, V only acts on the upper 2x2 block. So I can write the upper 2x2 block as V dagger times the pion part. So pi over square root of 2, pi plus, pi minus, and then minus pi 0 over square root of 2, V. All right, so the pion part of M transforms in the adjoint representation. The eta part is just proportional to the identity for the upper 2x2 block, so it doesn't transform under V. So V dagger and V will kill each other, and you'll just be left with what you had before, eta over square root of 6 times the identity for the 2x2 block. All right, so that was one block here. For the lower block, the eta in the 3-3 component, of course, that's just the same thing. So that's also invariant. So the eta, of course, doesn't transform under under isospin. It's just a singlet under isospin. Now we have the kaons. And so what you get for the lower components is you'll get k minus k bar 0 times v dagger. And up here, you'll get v times k plus k0 here. So this tells you how the different states in M transform under isospin. The pions transform in the adjoint representation. They are a triplet of the SU2 isospin. The eta is a singlet under isospin. And the kaon multiplets are both doublets under isospin. Sorry. That should be, yeah, thank you. That's right. That's right. Yep. Thanks. Okay. So the quantum number that we identified before as I3, the three component of isospin, is nothing more than just T3, right? It's just a subgroup of SU3 flavor. So what we called I3 before is just the T3 generator of SU3 flavor. Okay. So that's one of the quantum numbers that we used for plotting all of the states in the octet representation. Now what we want to do is think about strangeness. Before we talk about strangeness, it's useful to note that there's also a third quantum number, which we could also write down, which is just baryon number. In a sense, it's kind of trivial, because every state in the multiplet has the same baryon number. Obviously, for the meson, it has baryon number 0. But for the baryon multiplets, they have baryon number 1. All the states will have the same baryon number. So in terms of flavor space, the baryon operator would just be proportional to the identity. So we're free to define any quantum number we like just by adding a multiple of the identity to anything. So since baryon number is also a good quantum number, of a multiplet, we can define strangeness to be 1 over the square root of T3, sorry, 1 over the square root of 3 times T8 minus the baryon number. And this would just be times the identity in flavor space. Like this. A baryon is states with three quarks, and so a baryon number for a state with three quarks is just 1. So the proton and neutron have baryon number 1. It's really actually irrelevant for this discussion because we're talking about mesons, but I'm writing down things which would be more general. You could talk about the baryon multiplets as well. In this case, you can just think of strangeness as just defined as related to T8. But if you're talking about baryons, you have to make a more generalized definition of strangeness, where it also includes T8, but also the baryon number in this combination. So, okay.
Why do you put
T8? You should think of this as just a definition. T8, I argued, is a good quantum number to define all of these states. And so I can label each of these states by T8. I can also label them by their baryon number, which is trivial because they all have the same baryon number. For the case of the mesons, it's just 0. But for the case of the baryon multiplets, it's just 1. So instead of labeling them by T8 and baryon number, I could also label them by an arbitrary linear combination of those two things. And I'm defining a quantity such as that, which is just called S. And S will end up being the strangeness. Is that clear? You can think of it as a definition, and it'll turn out that this is strangeness. You can approach it from that direction, too. So in a sense, this is kind of unnecessary, since B is equal to 0 for the meson multiplet. All right. So now we can classify all of the states in the multiplet. Let's just do that. Here's the states. We have the pi plus, pi 0, pi minus, eta, k plus, k 0, k 0 bar, and k minus. So those are the eight states in the octet for the pseudoscalar mesons. There was also a ninth state, which was not part of the octet. It was the singlet. Remember, we had a 3 cross a 3 bar, and it decomposed as the octet plus a singlet. And so I'll just write the singlet as well, eta prime. So all of these are in the octet. And let's just list all of their quantum numbers. So I have I3, which is just equal to T3. I have, I can also talk about I, which is just the analog of the total spin quantum number. This is like the 3 component. There's also T8. And then I can just talk about S, which is the definition I wrote down, 1 over square root of 3, T8 minus B times the identity. So I told you that all of these states could be labeled by their T3 and their T8. So let's just write down what they are. You just compute the commutators. You get 1, 0, minus 1. This is a 0. This is 1 half, minus 1 half. This is 1 half, minus 1 half. And this one is 0. So this makes sense. These all form a multiplet under isospin. And so the total isospin quantum number would just be 1 for each of these things. It's like they're in the spin 1 state. And you have the 3 spins, 1, 0, and minus 1. This one is just a singlet. So it's just in, has I equals 0. These two are doublets. And so they have total spin 1 half, total isospin 1 half. And then the eta prime is also a singlet. And so it's just 0. Now let me also write down the T8 quantum numbers for all of these things. So it turns out that this one will have 0. 0, 0, and 0. This is square root of 3, square root of 3, minus square root of 3, minus square root of 3. And this one is 0. So now if I just take this linear combination, I get the strangeness, which is 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1, and then this is 0. So if we plot this on one axis and strangeness on the other axis, that's exactly what we wrote down before for the octet. So this is exactly what we wrote before for the eightfold way plot of I3 versus S. So there we go. That's how we find these quantum numbers, which were discovered empirically from the symmetry SU3. Okay. Now, we can also use the symmetry to write down the Lagrangian, not in terms of the quark at the quark level, but in terms of the meson fields. So we can write down an effective Lagrangian for the meson fields. It has to be consistent with the symmetry if we're only considering the strong part of the interaction. So, first, I want to write down the kinetic term. So I should write down a term like this, 1 half trace of d mu m, d mu m. And then the mass term would be 1 half, I'll call this mass mu 8 squared, trace of m squared. So this would be the free part of the Lagrangian for the meson fields. And it has to have this form because it has to preserve the symmetry of SU3, right? This is the only thing we can write down. I could also write down the singlet terms as well. So the singlet terms would be for the eta prime. So that, I don't have to worry about the symmetry part, it's just 1 half d mu eta prime d mu eta prime minus 1 half mu 1 squared, since it's the singlet mass, eta prime squared. Nope. Yeah, it doesn't look like that. Let me expand it out. You'll see what it looks like. So I'll expand out some of these terms. And then lastly, there's an interaction term as well. The interaction term includes the symmetry preserving terms from the strong interaction as well as symmetry violating terms. So we're just going to focus on the free Lagrangian. The numerical coefficients that I chose for the matrix M, so I have like the square roots of 2, square root of 6, those were all chosen so that when you expand out this Lagrangian, you get exactly what you'd expect from a canonically normalized kinetic term. So when you expand this out, with those numerical coefficients, you get 1 half d mu pi 0 squared minus 1 half mu 8 squared pi 0 squared. And then for the charge pion, since the pi 0 is a real field, pi plus and pi minus are complex fields. They're complex conjugates of one another. So that would be d mu pi plus d mu pi minus minus mu 8 squared pi plus pi minus. The eta term is also real. It would just like look like 1 half d mu eta squared minus 1 half mu 8 squared eta squared. There's the kaon terms as well. The kaons are also complex fields. K plus and K minus are complex conjugates. K and K bar are complex conjugates. So it looks like these pion terms. Then there's also the eta prime term, which is 1 half d mu eta prime squared minus 1 half mu 1 squared. It can have a different mass. Eta prime squared, and then plus the interaction. All right. So the consequence of SU3 flavor symmetry, if I don't worry about any terms that violate the symmetry, is that all of the masses in the Meson multiplet have the same mass. Sorry, I should say all the masses are the same, right? They're all set by one parameter, this mu 8 parameter. And the eta prime, in general, has a different mass because it's not required by the symmetry to have the same mass. So the prediction from exact SU3 flavor symmetry is that the pion masses should be equal to the kaon masses, should be equal to the eta masses. And it's just set by one parameter, which you don't know how to compute, mu8 squared. But these are things that you can measure, and then you can check whether or not this is satisfied. So you can open up the PDG. And you'll see that it's not satisfied very well. So the mass of the pions are around 140 MeV. The mass of the kaon is around 500 MeV. The mass of the eta is around 550 MeV. So it doesn't really work that well. And so one of the important things that breaks the symmetry is the fact that the strange quark mass is not that light compared to the scale of QCD. Its mass is around 100 MeV compared to the QCD scale of around 200 MeV. So there's violations of SU3 flavor from the strange quark mass. And so let's see how we can put those effects into the Lagrangian and into the predictions for the masses. So SU3 flavor is only approximate. Uh, So a large source of SU3 breaking comes from MS, which is much, much larger than MU and MD. All right. So let's go back to the original quark Lagrangian. We had the Lagrangian was Q bar I D slash minus. Now let's put in the strange quark mass. Let's keep the up and down quark masses to be some common parameter M0. But I'll put in the strange quark mass to be something else, MS. Plus other terms that violate the symmetry, like, yeah?
When you're expanding out this kinetic term here, how do you get the d mu pi plus and d mu pi minus? So it'd be like an MM star in the trace, or how did you get this?
Yeah, so you can see M dagger is equal to M for the meson. So if we just take the dagger of this, you'll get complex conjugated fields. For example, K plus dagger, sorry, K plus star will be equal to K minus, and so M is equal to M dagger.
But won't you also take the conjugate, or sorry, the transpose?
Yeah, so you have to take the conjugate and then transpose it. That's right. So when you, all I'm saying is that M is equal to M dagger. You can do it and see.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So it doesn't matter. I could have written M dagger here if that makes. That makes it more transparent, but it doesn't matter. And I could have written this as M dagger M. Doesn't matter. It's the same. OK. So all right. So let me rewrite this term as Q bar I D slash minus. Let me factor out the part that is preserving the flavor symmetry. So I have just this. This is the term I had before. But now I have another term, which looks like 0, 0. Actually, let me write it just in terms of another matrix, delta. Plus, I have another matrix, which I'll call delta S Q, plus symmetry breaking interactions. So this matrix delta S is equal to 0, 0, MS minus M0. And this is just approximately equal to 0, 0, ms, since this holds. So all of the symmetry breaking is going to be factored in to this matrix delta S. Obviously, this matrix breaks the symmetry since it picks out a preferred component along that direction. All right. So now what we want to know is how do we write down the effective theory involving mesons? How do we generalize the Lagrangian on the other side of the board to include the effects of this delta? And again, we can't actually compute anything directly because it involves strong physics. But what we want to do is just use symmetry to restrict the form of this interaction, of these terms. So even though delta S breaks the symmetry, we can actually restore the symmetry by treating delta S as what's called a spurion. So we're going to treat this matrix delta S as a spurion. That just means we're going to assume that it actually does transform under the field under the symmetry transformation, even though it actually doesn't. So here's the argument. If we assume that delta S transforms as delta S goes to U delta S U dagger, then symmetry is restored. Right? Since Q bar delta S Q would just go to Q bar U dagger. Then we have a U delta S U dagger, and then we have a U Q, and so that's just Q bar delta S Q. So if we make this assumption, we treat delta S as transforming under the transformation, which it doesn't, but this is just a trick, then the symmetry is restored. Now what we can do is we can allow the Lagrangian to include delta S just by writing down all possible terms, including delta S, that preserve that also are that preserve the symmetry. So now we can include delta S in the effective theory for M by writing down symmetry preserving terms. With delta S. And I'm also going to mention, I'm only going to work at leading order in delta S. So I'm only going to write down terms in the Lagrangian that have just one factor of delta S in them. So here's the Lagrangian. I have what I had before, which is 1 half trace of d mu m, d mu m. I have minus 1 half mu 8 squared trace of m squared. And then I can write down a term involving as follows, 1 half alpha times the trace of delta S m squared, like this. So this term is also allowed based on the symmetry. But we don't know this coefficient alpha. Now, we also have another. Now we can also write terms involving the eta prime. We also have plus 1 half d mu eta prime squared minus 1 half mu 1 squared eta prime squared. And I can also write down another term, which is 1 half beta eta prime trace of delta S m. So that's also another term that's invariant under the symmetry. And then I have lastly a third term, which is 1 half gamma times eta prime squared times the trace of delta S by itself. So, and then I have interaction terms as well. So those are all the terms, I think, of what I can write down involving just one power of delta S, which is invariant under the symmetry. And again, I don't know how to compute what alpha, beta, and gamma are. So those will be things that we don't know. So now, let's just expand out the mass terms for all of these fields. So the Lagrangian will be kinetic terms, which we won't worry about. Those are just the same. And then the mass terms will be, I'll have a 1 half mu 8 squared, and then I'll have the pion fields. So I'll have pi 0 squared plus pi plus pi minus with a factor of 2. So I have the pion mass terms. I have the kaon mass terms, which is 1 half mu 8 squared plus alpha ms over 2. And then I have 2 k 0 k bar 0 plus 2 k plus k k minus. So the symmetry breaking enters in here. And now lastly, for the eta and eta prime, I have 1 half eta, eta prime as a row vector times a mass matrix, which is mu 8 squared plus 2 thirds alpha ms minus beta ms over the square root of 6 minus beta ms over the square root of 6. And then in this component, I have mu 1 squared plus gamma ms. And then I have eta, eta prime. And it looks like this. So the power of the Spurion technique is it just fixes the symmetry breaking terms in the Lagrangian just based on symmetry, even though we have no idea how to calculate the actual coefficients, because they involve strong interaction physics. Now, you can see from this that the symmetry breaking term delta S has two very important effects. First of all, it destroys the degeneracy between the different states. So the pion terms will have one mass, the kaons will have another mass, and the eta, eta prime system will also be affected. The second important effect is that it mixes the eta, which came from the octet, and the eta prime, which was the singlet. So there's mixing between the two things. So we've split the degeneracy. And we have eta, eta prime mixing. OK. So the physical eta and eta prime states, these are the ones that you would look up in the PDG, are actually an admixture of the octet eta and the singlet eta prime. So the states that we introduced here in M for the eta and eta prime are not actually the physical states that you would look up. They're admixtures of the two. And there's a mixing angle to describe that. But the mixing angle experimentally ends up being fairly small. Is pretty small. It's around 20 degrees. So what we're going to do here is we're just going to set the mixing to be 0 to see how the masses change. So what I'm going to do is just make the approximation that beta is negligible. OK, so this will just be an approximation. So all I mean is that, so let me call the physical state, the physical eta, like eta hat, let's say. This is like cosine theta of the eta that I wrote down in the octet. Let's see, I forget if it's plus or minus, but let's say it's minus. Minus sine theta times the singlet field that we wrote down in the singlet. And then the physical eta prime, I'll call it like this, would be cosine theta of the eta prime plus sine theta of the eta. These are the octet and the singlet states. These are the physical states that you would just that are you know have a these are the mass eigenstates. Yeah, all the PDG data is for these states, and they don't have hats on them, so they actually call them eta and eta prime. I should take the hats off and call this eta octet and eta prime singlet, like this. So these are the mass eigenstates. These are the eigenstates under SU3 flavor. So these are the octet, and this is the singlet. OK. But experimentally, it turns out, and there's a reason why, this mixing can be neglected at sort of the 10% level, because the mixing angle ends up being kind of small. OK. So now what we're going to see is how this relation between the masses changes due to the symmetry breaking terms. So we have m pi squared is equal to mu 8 squared. We have mk squared is equal to mu 8 squared plus alpha ms over 2. And then m eta squared is equal to mu 8 squared plus 2/3 alpha ms. So that's what we get, neglecting mixing. Okay, so we can take linear combinations. What we get is that for mk squared is equal to, so that's equal to 4 times mu 8 squared plus 2 alpha ms. And that's equal to m pi squared plus 3 m eta squared. So you can compute this, and you can compute this, and they're both equal to this. So now, instead of saying that the relations between these three individual masses all have to be the same, we have this relation, which is just one relation between the three masses. And so you can look in the PDG and see, just plug in the numbers here and see if it's satisfied. And it turns out, yes, it is satisfied at the sort of 5% level. So this relation here is satisfied at sort of the 5% level. And I think the most important reason why it doesn't work better than this is just because we're neglecting this mixing here between eta and eta prime, which is order like a 10 or 20% effect. So the fact that it works at that level is good. Okay. So the conclusion is that even though SU3 flavor symmetry is broken, the symmetry also tells us how we go beyond the symmetry. How do we include symmetry violating terms? And they give us relations which are satisfied experimentally. Okay. Any questions on this before we move on to something else?
Why couldn't you just have a trace delta S in from? Why do you have to pair it with eta prime?
Okay, let's see. Oh, this? Just this?
Yeah, why couldn't you also add a term like that?
Yeah, right, okay. So that, you could forbid that one by parity conservation. So because I didn't mention anything about that at all, but parity also restricts the form of terms in Lagrangian as well, since the strong interaction conserves parity. So if you just have this, it would be parity odd, because this is parity odd. And so you need two pseudoscalars in the Lagrangian to get something that's parity even. Yeah, it's a good question. Thanks. All right, so now we're going to do flavor physics very, very briefly. So we talked about states involving the light quarks. We could also think about hadrons with heavy quarks. Of course, I'm just talking about charm and bottom here. So let me just list the lightest pseudoscalar, so the 0 plus states. So you have charmed mesons, which are called D. I'll just list also their quark content. and a mass. So you have D0 and D bar 0, which are C U bar and U C bar. And the mass is around 1865. You have D plus and D minus. So that's a C D bar and then D C bar. The mass is around 1870. DS plus and DS minus, which is a CS bar and then SC bar. And the mass of this is around 1968. So you can see right away that the mass of these mesons is much larger than the lightest pseudoscalars for the light quarks. And that's just because the mass is mostly set by the mass of the charm quark, which is around 1.5 GeV. Yeah, for the charm quark, I don't know off the top of my head. I don't know if anyone knows. No, it's relatively short. I don't know. You'd have to look it up. For the bottom quark, the lifetime, I should say for the bottom mesons, which we'll talk about now, the lifetime is around 10 to the minus 12 seconds, which is fairly long. 10 to the minus 15 for charm? Yeah. Oh, it's in the tutorial. Yeah, okay. Okay, yeah, good. So there's also bottom mesons. People also call bottom beauty sometimes. Before people had the notation of top and bottom, people called it truth and beauty. And so beauty is kind of stuck a little bit, but truth is no one uses that. But people do sometimes call these things beauty mesons. So you have a B plus and a B minus, which is, let me just write them all down first. You have B0, B0 bar. You have B0, B0 bar 0. And you have B C plus and B C minus. So the quark content here, you have U, B bar, B, U bar. You have D, U bar, D, B. You have S, B bar, B S bar, and C B bar, B C bar. And then the masses here are 5279, 5280, 5367, and then 6275. Again, much, much heavier than the light quark mesons, and it's mostly just set by the mass of the bottom quark, which is around 4.5 GeV. There's also vector states. So these are the 1 minus states. Those would be like the analogs of the rho, the k star, the omega, and the phi. For these, you get the vectors just by adding a star. Just add a star. So it's like going from k to k star. Those are just the pseudoscalar and the vector. Yeah, thank you. B, D bar. Yep, great. That's right. Yeah, parity minus. It's JP. Lastly, there are states called quarkonium. And there are two types of quarkonium. There's charbonium, and then there's bottomonium. So charbonium are CC bar states. It's kind of like the analog of positronium. Right? E plus E minus bound state. Quarkonium is a QQ bar bound state of the same flavor. So charmonium, there's many, many states again, and there's the lightest one is called eta C, and it's the zero minus state, and it's a CC bar. The mass is around 2984. It's mostly just 2 times the quark, the charm quark mass. And then there's another one called J psi, which is very famous. It's the vector one. So again, it's CC bar, and the mass is 3097. All right. So again, here's the pseudoscalar, and here's the vector. Okay. And then lastly, I'll just write it over here. You have bodomonium. There's the eta B, which is the zero minus state. And that's BB bar. And the mass is 9398. And then there's another one called the upsilon, which is 1 minus. And it's BB bar. And it's 9460. And again, these are only the lightest ones. And there's many, many more, which are you can think of as excited states in the quark antiquark potential, plus excited states. OK, so I'm just listing the lightest ones. And it has a very similar form to what we wrote down before. If SU4 flavor or SU5 flavor were good symmetries, then these would be the states that you would need to complete those representations of SU4 or SU5 to generalize the flavor symmetry to include the bottom and or charm quarks. So similar to strangeness, S, we can introduce 2 new quantum numbers. One is called charm, because by capital C, and it's defined that C, the C quark has charm plus 1. Should say C equal plus 1, and C bar has C equals minus 1. And there's also another quantum number, which is just called bottomness B. And so the B has bottomness minus 1. And the B bar has bottomness plus 1. The reason it was kind of switched is just to copy what was done for strangeness. That was just a historical accident that we had to give the strange quark strangest minus 1. And then when we discovered bottom quarks, I think we just copied what we had before just to keep it consistent. But this, OK, it's flipped. All right. So. Processes that violate S, C, or B must occur via the weak charge current. Right? It's only the interaction of the W, which is violating flavor for quarks. So if I'm violating one of these flavors, it has to occur through a process with the W. So by looking at flavor violation, where we're changing S, C, or B allows us to test the consistency of the CKM mechanism for flavor violation. The standard model is very predictive. All of the flavor, every single flavor violating interaction you can write down has to be parameterized by the elements of the CKM matrix. So if we measure all possible flavor-violating interactions, those will give us consistency relations between those matrix elements, which we can test. We can test, does it make sense to describe all of these processes through just a few parameters? So there's a very important class of observables. Called flavor changing neutral currents called FC and Cs. So what I mean by a flavor changing neutral current is as follows. So FC and C would be any one of these transitions. So we have S to D transitions, B to D transitions, and then B to S transitions, or C to U transitions. So neutral current just means you're changing between quark flavors, but with the same charge. So it's a neutral current because it doesn't change the charge of the quark flavor. All right, so, okay, FC and Cs are forbidden in the standard model at tree level, since the Z and the photon preserve flavor, right? So we showed that all the interactions of the Z and the photon keep the flavor the same. And so there's no way to have a neutral current transition between any two flavors. But at one loop order, FC and Cs can arise. OK. So let's see how this works. And I'm just going to consider one possible example. So I'll do k0 to mu plus mu minus. So this is a, it's a D and an S bar going into leptons. And so this is an example of a D to S transition, or an S to D transition. And then it's going to something that doesn't have any flavor. So at one loop order, I can write down the matrix element in terms of the Feynman diagrams. So I have an S bar and a D, which make up the K0. So it occurs at one loop. So I have a W. I need to have a W because that's the only thing that changes flavor. And then in the loop, I have a U, C, or a T quark. And then I have a Z or a photon here that goes to mu plus mu minus, like this. And this one is also a U, C, or T. Okay? Because of course, this interaction doesn't violate the flavor. And there's another diagram I could write down, which is a box diagram like this. Oh, not like that. Box diagram like this. So I have a S bar, and again, I have a U, C, or a T, and a D, and then I have W, and then I have a mu plus, a neutrino, and a mu minus, like this. I think that conserves charge. So these are the diagrams I need to include. And again, all of the flavor violation is occurring through the W vertices, which are proportional to the CKM matrix elements. And of course, when I compute these two diagrams, I have to sum over all possible states in the intermediate loop. So I should be summing over U, C, and T. So let me just call this UI. I is just 1, 2, and 3. So this vertex here will involve VIS. And this one will involve VID star. No, VID, VIS star. This one will involve VIS star. And this one is also VID. So the matrix element is roughly proportional to something of the form as follows. We have to sum over all of the quarks in the loop. So I have to sum over I. And then I'll write down the CKM matrix elements. So I have a VIS star, VID. And then I'll have some loop integral, which will, OK, so I do that. It'll be some function of the masses entering into the loop. So I'll just write it as a function of the mass of the intermediate state, mui divided by mw. It'll be some function of that. So f is some loop function, something you get from the loop integral. All right. So now what I want to say is, in the limit where all of the masses of these quarks in the loop are degenerate, or equivalently, if they're much, much lighter than the W mass, then they are degenerate because I could just take them to be 0, then this part of the term is independent of I. So if M UI is the same for all quarks, then F is independent of I. Or it holds if MUI is much, much less than MW. Then again, it doesn't matter that they're different as long as they're much less than the W mass. So this, for the sake of argument, if this holds, this would be independent of I. So now I can write down the matrix element as something proportional to the sum over I, VIS star, VID, times something independent of I. Now, if I look at this, I should think about this as matrix multiplication. And what it is V dagger V. And then I'm taking the S D elements of V dagger V. Now we know, of course, that V is unitary. So V dagger V just gives us 1. So I should think about that. And the components is just the Kronecker delta. And it's just equal to the Kronecker delta of S D. So that's just the Kronecker delta of 2, 1, which of course is just equal to 0. So in the limit that the masses satisfy this condition, the amplitude has to vanish based on the unitarity of the CKM matrix. This feature is called the Gym mechanism. So this is called the Jim mechanism after Glashow, Eliopoulos, Maiani. Just says in the limit of massless quarks, compared to MW, all FC and Cs must vanish. All right. So now you're probably saying, OK, who cares about that? Because the top quark is, of course, much, much larger than the W mass. Well, not much larger, a factor of 2 larger than the W mass or so. So doesn't that violate the Jim mechanism assumption? Yes, it does. But to get the top quark in the loop, you have to go through the CKM matrix elements that produce the top quark. I have to put in a VTS and a VTD. So the T quark is massive, but VTD times VTS is not a big number. It's around 3 times 10 to the minus 4. So even though you can have the top quark in the loop, which violates the Jim mechanism, allows us to evade the Jim mechanism, we have to go through very small elements in the CKM matrix. So just to summarize, FCNCs are suppressed by a loop factor plus some combination of CKM and Jim suppression. So FCNCs end up being very, very suppressed in the standard model, which means that by measuring these things, we have a very, very sensitive probe to any kind of new process which might come in, even if that mass scale is much, much larger than the scale of the W or the Z. OK. So that's all for now. And we'll pick up tomorrow. Yeah, so it changes flavor of the quarks without changing the charges of those quarks.
But why do you need the right half when you get the muons?
So I'm just looking at this one particular decay. So this is a decay that can be searched for, k0 to mu plus mu minus. And so I need the muon part just to give me something that, so where it's decaying to that.
But, I mean, couldn't you flip the quarks without the right hand side?
Sure, yeah. So this is just one example of an FCNC, but there's lots of other examples as well, which don't involve leptons.
Okay.